Hello and welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast. The URC quarterfinals have been and gone. Leinster through to the last four, 33-21 winners against the Scarlets at the Aviva Stadium last Saturday. They faced Glasgow Warriors on Saturday afternoon. Munster are out, a thrilling 24-all draw with the Sharks in Durban before an agonising defeat in a place-kicking competition. Sharks are away to the Bulls in the last four on Saturday evening. Bernard Jackman and Johnny Holland are my guests this week. Fellas, how are we doing?
Great, thank you.
We won't start with this weekend's games, the quarterfinals or semifinals, because Connacht took over the news agenda yesterday. They've appointed Stuart Lancaster as their new head coach on a two-year contract. He comes in replacing Pete Wilkins. The statement reads, Lancaster will also have a responsibility for defence, thereby completing next season's coaching team. Joining him will be new attack coach Rod Sieb, scrum and contact coach Cully Tucker, and line-out and maul coach John Muldoon. Bernard, it probably caught a lot of people by surprise yesterday, that news. More so because I think people probably weren't expecting Connacht to be, no offence to Connacht, but to be going after and recruiting someone of Stuart Lancaster standing in the game. It's a really strong, ambitious appointment.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And I think I spoke to some Connacht players and staff last night, and they're invigorated by it. You know, I think it's been a tough season in Connacht, and obviously, they ended up finishing the season and a large part of the season with an interim coach. Some of that coaching staff weren't tied down for next year for different reasons. It hasn't been there's been no big talk of kind of big signings coming in over the summer, so they weren't sure where the province were going, to be honest, and that's never a good thing. But this has really given everybody a lot of hope, I think. And now, you know, they're going to go into a new stadium, a new training facility that's already opened, and you have clarity around who your head coach is, and you've got a head coach who has a very, very strong reputation in Ireland. He understands the Irish system well. He understands the Irish mentality. Obviously, he's looking to rebuild his career again, kind of like he did with Leinster, you know. And he doesn't need to rebuild his career, but he wants to. He's very ambitious and a very ambitious and hardworking coach. So he'll want to show with Connacht, with less resources, obviously, than he had in Racing 92, what he can do. And I think it's an amazing sign. I think I think it shows the RFU, because you have to think the RFU helped out in this, is that while they may be cutting budgets on players and other aspects of the game, it seems as if they're willing to make sure that there's top quality coaches coaching our players. So the Clayton McMillan deal certainly wouldn't have been a cheap deal. It would have taken a big investment, and I'm sure the RFU had to help out there. And likewise, Stuart Lancaster is another big statement. So with Munster and Connacht, you know that those players have coaches who hopefully can make them that will make them better based on a previous track record. So that's brilliant. I also think, just on another side of it here, is that probably the RFU for 20 years and David Nusafora and Joe Schmidt and have hoped to spread the talent out around the country a little bit differently. And there's been quite little movement, really. I actually think that Stuart Lancaster, in a year's time, will be able to attract players from Leinster. Players have worked with him before in a different way. It doesn't necessarily mean they'll go, but certainly it now makes going to Connacht more attractive, I think, because of his proven track record in developing players. You know, so that's another added advantage for Connacht fans, is that their recruitment now will be easier because they have, you know, a better training facility, better stadium, plus someone like Stuart Lancaster, who everybody who's worked with him says he made him a better player, and that's impressive.
Yeah, Johnny, the recruitment and retention aspect of it is quite important, because I think I was saying on the podcast a few weeks ago, I don't think either of you were on that particular one, but it was after Connacht's season had finished up and there was still obviously a lot of uncertainty around who was going to coach, and the kind of coupled with it the fact that there were no there essentially had been no movement on signings at that point. I know they've signed, the name escapes me, the fullback from the Highlanders for next season, but this was before they'd announced that signing. And I said it at the time, when you looked at how their season had finished and just the general story of how the last two seasons had gone, and now going into a period where they were looking for a head coach, I had real fears that we were going to be heading into a period where Connacht were potentially going to start fading away into obscurity a little bit and almost becoming an irrelevance as an Irish province or as a threat on the playoffs in the URC. But the last few weeks have kind of, well, the last few days in particular have changed that with Stuart Lancaster. And I think, as Bernard says, this time next season it'll be really interesting to see what players are staying at the province, but more importantly, what players are coming into the province.
Yeah, I think the IRFU have been getting a bit of flak lately, but like an appointment like this shows that, there is a method there, and I think investing in a coach like that, you're going to bring like all boats will rise basically in Connacht now. Like Bert is saying there that, he'll do very well with little resource. I think he is one of those coaches that will bring everyone's standard up. So I think they've done the right thing. I'm still disappointed by their retention. I think there's some players in other provinces at the moment, particularly in Munster with Kilgallen and Farrell. I know it's a different time and everything else, but imagine what he would have done if he had other players like that and Conor Oliver leaving and JJ gone. Like, I don't really understand what their strategy was around retention and never mind recruitment, because there's some good players gone out of Connacht, and I know we've spoken with that. But I think the thing with Stuart Lancaster is that he will bring people's levels up, he puts structures and systems, and he'll make it very effective and efficient, So, I think that's the excitement around it, but you have to think, like Bernard said, it's coming from the top down, and they recognize that to make people better and to get the most out of your resources, you put good people in place that can affect everyone, And he definitely seems to be one of those. And I do wonder, like, it seemed to slow down the Lancaster to Connacht rumors. Maybe that was investment needed from the IRFU to get it over the line. Who knows? And you do, like Bernard maybe half mentioned it or didn't want to mention it, but like, did he have any other offers? Because Connacht is hardly the place where he would have found himself after Leinster, after Racing, you know what I mean? But at the same time, there's a project there, and maybe that can get someone, it can light someone up in terms of going in and making real differences and real change in an Irish system that he's used to. So it'd be very interesting, but he certainly needs more backing as he's going. He can't just keep losing players now. And his ability to attract players would be one thing. Like, we've seen Richie Murphy do it in Ulster, but probably at a different level in terms of taking academy players and players he's worked with. And he's obviously very comfortable and used to the Irish system as well. Sure, Lancaster will be no different, but coming back with a huge level of coaching experience behind him. So it's really, really exciting for Connacht, and I'm delighted that there's finally some good news over in that part of the country, and they'll be more competitive next year. They have to be.
And Bernard, there's a question in on X here, and it kind of follows on from what Johnny was saying there about maybe how many offers might there have been in for Lancaster and the motive and what attracted him there. Ball handling hooker asks, number one, does Stu still commit from the UK? I suppose to answer that, I'm almost certain in the press release Lancaster made a point of saying himself and his wife are actually moving to Galway, so he won't be doing that commute back and forth from Leeds like he would have been at Leinster. But the second part of the question, does this appointment increase the potential of Stu being a potential Irish head coach in the future?
Yeah, it does. Obviously, for sure, if he comes into Connacht and has a big impact, his star will rise even more. In terms of does he have other options? He was, he's gonna be on the record. He was very, very close to the Australian job, and that's a fact. And only last Friday, I got a phone call from someone in Wales, kind of checking references and looking for more information about him. He was on the shortlist for the Welsh job, which hasn't been given out yet. So I think he. And if he sat tight, he could have got a more high-profile job. But I think he sees a real opportunity here. He loved his time in Ireland, and so did his partner. I think if you remember, there was no need for him at the start to be. It all kind of came a bit of a rush how he ended up in Ireland, and I don't think it's that. It was family reasons why he needed to be back up north quite a bit. I think obviously now is even is the kids have flown the
Kids
coop.
are grown up,
Yeah, they're grown up. He'll be there. And to be honest, I think what something is really interesting. So I remember Johnny Sexton saying that it took Andy Farrell to remind the Irish players what it was like to be an Irish player. Stuart Lancaster has probably had the biggest impact in the domestic game in terms of coaching, in terms of being a mentor to schools coaches in Leinster. He's had more of an impact in his time here than a lot of homegrown or native Irish do. You know, he's the type of fella who does really buy into it and wants to really understand what's going on and is a resource. And obviously it's difficult to do that in a club like Racing, you know, because there's no real fixed territory and a language barrier. But I think it won't be just on the field for Connacht here. Like, other coaches in the domestic game there will benefit from his willingness to give up his time. Like, he's unbelievably generous with his time. And I know a lot of people in Leinster really missed him when he left, because there wasn't anyone really to step into that void at the same level of dedication that he has. So, I think this is, I know what Johnny's saying, and you have to ask that question. It's not the most attractive job in the world. But I have no doubt if he had decided to sit tight, a bigger job on, you know, on paper would have come up. It's just, obviously, I think he sees something here that he can improve, and he certainly can. I mean, I think Connacht have been quite rudderless really for the last couple of seasons, and he will get more out of him for sure. I agree, also do agree with Johnny. I'd love to know. I hope he has total power. I hope there's no interference from above. I hope he's allowed to do it as he wants. And I hope he gets some help in terms of being able to recruit as well, because there is some good players leaving. And I think some of those players left because of lack of faith in what was happening. And I think, obviously, now I even think someone like JJ, it would be a harder move for JJ, I'd imagine, if he knew someone like Stuart was coming in.
The last question on Lancaster then, and it's one I'll put to both of you. I'll give it to you first, Bernard, but we're all very excited about it. We've been very positive about it. The big question mark remains, though, Stuart Lancaster as the senior coach, the tracksuit and whistle coach at Leinster, was highly respected. Are there still question marks over Stuart Lancaster, the head coach, running the operation? But also in line with that, does the fact that Billy Millard is coming in as that general manager of performance at Connacht, is he going to be able to take on a lot of the load that the traditional head coach might have been doing in terms of recruitment, contracts, stuff like that, the bigger picture things? Does that allow Lancaster to just get on with the day-to-day stuff of coaching?
Yeah, I'll go first, Johnny. That's okay. I think he has a real understanding of where his strengths are. And I think Billy Millard will be incredibly useful for him. I think, you know, there's no point having Stuart Lancaster and have him doing a lot of the DOR type roles, contracts, you know, managing up. And he's well able to do all that. But the reality is, what anyone who's worked with him says, his genius or his biggest strength is his ability to run unbelievably good training sessions. Training sessions where you're getting fitter, you're getting better, your tactical understanding improves, and everybody benefits from it. So he could have 60 players on, he won't have 60 players in Connacht because they won't have them, but he could have 60 players out in the field for 70 minutes. And the way he organizes training sessions, nearly everybody will get the same amount of exposure, if that makes sense. And that is obviously something that he's incredibly good at. Ironically, that's probably less valued in France, because the players, particularly in Racing, they don't have that understanding of the benefits of that, you know, and how important that can be. Because sometimes over there, pure athleticism, you know, decides who's first choice, second choice, third choice. But I think that would be, he through his time in Leinster, through his time in Racing, his experience with England, etc., I think he knows now getting that balance right. I think Billy Millard, coming in as general manager, he will allocate a lot of the stuff that he doesn't want to do or doesn't need to do to make sure he can do what he does best.
Would you still be pretty confident, Johnny, as Stuart Lancaster as a head coach?
Yeah, I think so, because like Bernard said, most of there, but you just get the feeling that he's a really organised, I wouldn't say structured in a way that sounds negative, but it just comes across, like Leinster never felt more clear on what they were trying to do when he was there. And I think that's, obviously, looking from the outside in, I don't know what's happened in Leinster or what's going to happen with Connacht, but like, I just get the feeling that he'll offer serious clarity to a place, like Bernard has said, looked rudderless, or they didn't really know their identity. I think he'll work really hard on that. Like, obviously, he pops up on my LinkedIn with these leadership masterclasses, and I suppose every head coach or everyone with his level of experience in coaching could probably do something like that. But it is still something that would make me think he's into that side of, really clear leadership, or transferring his communication, his tactics. It just You get the feeling he's just really structured, organized, very clear in what he's trying to do. But we'll see. We'll see if he can do that. I think he will. I think the Irish system probably helps him in that sense, that it's a bit more of a structured system too, So I do think he'll get a lot of that across, but I'd be excited to see how much he can do in Connacht, because, like Bernard said, the resources aren't deep in terms of player pool, but you could uncover a lot of gems there. You're getting a lot of time under Stuart Lancaster that nobody has ever heard of. They'll be playing in 2A in the AIL, and they could be in
Yeah.
the Connacht sub-academy or something like that, and all of a sudden you'll get a senior player in 2 years' time if they can leech off Stuart Lancaster and what he can provide.
Absolutely. Really looking forward to seeing it next season. And actually, final point on it as well, Bernard. Just good to see Colly Tucker staying on with Connacht as well, because I know there was a lot of uncertainty around what his role was going to be, if he was going to be at Connacht next season. But I suppose having dealt with him a lot more in the final third of the season when he had kind of taken on the reins, I was always enjoyed chatting to him, always enjoyed dealing with him, and it's good to see him hanging around even longer.
Yeah, absolutely, and it was a nice bit. It was a nice opportunity for him to get that block of time where he's running the show. But he's still such a young coach. And again, I think working with someone of the experience of Stuart, and particularly how he tries to develop leadership and develop people, I think he'll go into this summer, I'd imagine, excited to take his career to the next level. I think he's come through the Connacht Academy, and now he's very much recognised as being a very good coach in his own right. But I would have thought the head coach job in Connacht for him might have came too soon. But certainly next time around, potentially he'll be someone that can step into that role.
Yeah, it's good to see it for him. Probably makes sense to segue to Leinster from here, since we're talking about Stuart Lancaster. And I think, Johnny, as you kind of said, one of you said anyway in the last few minutes, Leinster never looked as clear in what they were doing than when Stuart Lancaster was there. The WhatsApp group of the rugby team I play in over the weekend was hopping with quite a few people in the last few days, saying they would take Stuart Lancaster back in a heartbeat with the way things have gone over the last while. But Leinster, 33-21 winners against the Scarlets in front of just under 13,000 supporters at the Aviva last Saturday. They'll host Glasgow again this weekend. Johnny, it was 12-0 to Leinster inside just 10 minutes. James Lowe, Jameson Gibson-Park both scored tries. Looked like they'd found their groove again. They've brushed everything off. Okay, they look like the old Leinster again. But by half time, it's only 15-14. They're looking lethargic, high energy count, inaccurate around the breakdown, sometimes really, really frantic in attack. They eventually see it out. Jamie Osborne gets that try just after half time and eventually needed Sam Prendergast's penalty to just kind of make sure of the game in the final 10 minutes. I know they won, but can we officially say there's a Champions Cup hangover happening with Leinster at the moment?
Yeah, I was thinking with this Champions Cup hangover, maybe just a bit of fatigue in terms of the chat around them and not winning and when they'll win. And I don't know how much of that infiltrates.
Can I enter, like, are we talking mental fatigue as much as physical fatigue?
Yeah, mental fatigue. Sorry, nothing to do with physical fatigue. They're
Okay.
well managed. There's no way a team like that with the resources they have should be physically fatigued. Now, bear in mind, internationals go through a long season. Their break is different to the players playing in the league, I suppose, if you want to put it that way. And sometimes I would have seen internationals coming back to training thinking, yeah, they get probably a week or even 2 weeks cut off their downtime. So they do, like, internationals probably go through it a lot more than others, even though they'll be managed by the IRFU. It just feels like it's kind of squeezed in and they're under pressure to come back, and they're chomping to get back and catching up with pre-season, all that kind of stuff. So I do think they've a long kind of road travelled, obviously a team with a lot of internationals in it. And then you also question, like, there's a lot of them picked for the Lions, and how much of that is weighing on their mind, and injury in the next couple of weeks. Obviously, they want to win ERC. I think the narrative is that it doesn't make up at all for a Champions Cup, which I agree with in one sense, but I still believe that the biggest thing they need to do now is actually just win it and get it done.
Oh yeah, like it's a. I think myself and Eddie O'Sullivan were saying it a couple of weeks ago. They've landed themselves in this catch-22 where they're not really going to get much credit for winning the URC, but they have to win it.
They do. They have to win it. But if you look at their performance at the weekend, Scarlett broke out at times, and I think Blair Murray was absolutely outstanding. He's something
Brilliant.
else. Like a kind of a fullback you'd love to have to be able to coach him, because he just looks like he'd do whatever you say, and that bit more as well. Kicking from his 22 to 60 meters down pitch, down the pitch just regularly. They couldn't get territory in the second half just to kill off the game, Leinster. But yeah, Leinster, like we said the word clunky a lot in terms of attack in the last while, but they did look very clunky, and they looked like they couldn't see off Scarlets when they needed to. A couple of overthrows, a couple of visits to the 22 that they didn't put away. That I suppose the reason I'm saying it is because they always have put it away, and they didn't. And then I was just disappointed by, the entry at the end of the half at 15-7 and Sam Prendergast's reaction to the ball being dropped. I was disappointed by that. He's like, we speak about how he's such a good player, and then I don't know, I just feel like he's playing his own game at the moment, spiraling to touch and missing it. You don't need to, like, it's just whipping out a spiral for no real reason at that stage. The risk of a spiral to touch is that you don't catch it and you do what he did there, So, like, there's one or two things that I'd just be disappointed around that kind of effort on transition, but Scarlett's lived in the game, in fairness to them, like, and they pounce on their opportunities, and I think they put it up to Leinster, but that performance isn't going to do it from Leinster. And the only other thing I would say is that the minute you question Leinster in general, they'll have a response next week, and they'll give Glasgow a battering. But like, I think the confidence in saying that isn't as strong as what you would have said before.
No, it certainly isn't. And Bernard, on Sam Prendergast, like, he had some lovely moments in the game. Like that little dink over the top for Jamie Osborne's try. It's a beautiful score for James Lowe's try. There was a lovely little bit of quick hands there. But there are times in games, particularly in since the end of the Six Nations, I'd say, where you can just see the confidence is dropping ever so slightly. It's becoming far more inconsistent. Like I think earlier on in the season, I think when he was getting into the Irish team back in November, I think he was generally playing very, very consistent games. And I think if you look back now, you're probably looking at two very, very different players. It's been a long season for him, obviously, still just 22 years of age, but he does look like someone who's just starting to feel it a little bit now.
Yeah, I think what he's going through is probably part and parcel of the process for a 10 in their life cycle as a pro rugby player. But like where they build you up and we build them up, and then everything they do is their strengths are magnified as being incredibly good, and then we look for weaknesses, and we attack those, or they're attacked, and they get exposed, and potentially you lose confidence, which certainly looks like his confidence isn't as high as it was, and everything becomes a real struggle. The problem for Sam is I would say a normal life cycle of a 10 is that happens in year 3, year 4. You kind of you they build, 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 and then the cracks appear or the weakness appear, and they got to find a way to fix those, and then they go again if they're lucky enough to have that resilience and support around them and talent, obviously. And then they're on the right track. Like the George Fords, the Owen Farrells, the Dan Biggers, etc. If you look at their careers, they've all had a period where they were doubted, and their ability to be the man was questioned. But they've all, in their own ways, got through that and overcome it. The problem for Sam is it all came in basically, if you
In
went,
one
you
season.
say, from the 1st of November to the end of May, that's effectively his life cycle is that, you know what I mean? And the hype has been incredible, and based around some skills that he has that are quite special. And now the drop off has been quite drastic as well. And unfortunately for him, you would have to say he's playing in a team at the moment who, over the last two, it's only two games, but even within Northampton, Leinster weren't where they needed to be. And then obviously, forget about Zebre, but then Glasgow, last round of URC, and Scarlets, they were as poor performances Leinster put in all year. And it's not all down to Sam, but the focus is on him. And if you're starting 10 for Leinster, you need to be pretty good every week, I think, or whatever. So now the challenge is what's happening around Sam to see if he can bounce back quickly and finish the season off with a URC and have a good summer tour with the Irish team, etc. But I would say it's typical. It's just being able to identify that and have the right support and experience around you to make sure that it doesn't become a situation where you really doubt yourself and you start to lose confidence, and it affects your performances. And the issue I have with Leinster is that, well, one, I think there's definitely a hangover, and two, even though they got a great start the other night, as soon as any bit of momentum went against them, you could see them nearly close up, close up and make more errors and allow the team back in. So my fear is, if at Glasgow were to get a fast start, are Leinster in the place that they can actually deal with that? And if they are also kind of get the energy levels up to where they need to be, because they look listless. They look listless, and it can be very hard to pick it up. But that's what you want in your team. Like Glasgow last year did it the hard way, going away and winning the trophy. Munster, when they won the URC, did it the hard way. Leinster still have the easy way, realistically. And it's down to their own consistency during the season. But the reality is now they have the easier run to the final based on having home advantage if they can get through to it, and having played the lower seeds on the way to it, on the way to the final. So there is no excuse, as there was no excuse against Northampton. Doesn't mean you're guaranteed to win it by any manner of means. But what I'm worried about Leinster is this. So I think Jacques Nienaber is an unbelievably good coach, like unbelievably good. And even though the Leinster attack wasn't all singing, all dancing, the players really believed in Tyler, right? And effectively, they were building this game plan from the bottom up, which was built around that defensive strength. And attack was a layer on top of that. And then suddenly after the Six Nations, and look at it, you could say it was because Harlequins and Glasgow were so poor. But Leinster, there was a shift in how Leinster were trying to play, Neil. There was a shift, right? And it led to unbelievably impressive score lines and elements of the performance which looked amazing. But it wasn't real life. It wasn't what you need to win knockout rugby, because you're not going to, highly likely, you're going to win a semi-final, final, or final by 60 points. So, even though it has happened in the past, but it's not how you would expect it to happen. Now, what are Leinster trying to achieve? They're not, you watched that match against the Scarlets. Would you tell me that's a Jack Nienaber defence? I didn't
No,
see.
I was looking at it this morning. They made 48 tackles and they missed 16. That's a 65%
But even
tackle
but
rate.
I don't even think.
Scarlett scored 21, scored three tries, 21 points from, I think, about 35% possession.
Yeah, well, forget about the one before halftime. That's a breakaway. But I actually don't even. I'm not when I look at Jack Nienaber defense, I'm not worried about the missed tackle percentage. What I'm
The
actually more interested
energy isn't there
in, yeah,
compared to 6 months ago.
100%. I think, we saw games earlier on in the year where you were blown away by how Leinster wanted to defend. You know what I mean? And you were sitting up where we are at up high, and you're in no doubt. You watch the Leinster defence versus the opposition, and one is coached by Jack. You know what I mean? At the weekend and against Glasgow in the last round, I didn't see that. And at that, I didn't see that. And you could argue it wasn't there for Northampton either, even though there was elements of it there. It wasn't there. It wasn't there. That's the challenge, is why have the players dropped off in that effort level of applying a system that they now should know inside out, right? And again, I don't doubt Jack's system. I think for some reason, Leinster have got caught in this no man's land of not being really sure how they want to defend or attack. And that sounds ridiculously stupid. And maybe it is. But that's how, looking at them over the last two games, I couldn't write down three bullet points on defence and attack and say that's what Leinster were trying to do and that's what they'll do next week. If that makes sense. And where that's gone missing, I don't know. That's what Leinster need to find this week. And Leo needs to find it, because he is responsible for, if he's the head coach, he's responsible for selection, the game plan, and overall mindset. Like, that's his job. His job is to get those players in a position where they believe in that they're going to win, they have the energy to win, and try and make them as resilient as possible if things go against them. And one of the things he said post-match, which I find strange, is is effectively that everyone was getting ahead of themselves. He referenced Northampton three times in the press conference without being asked a question about Northampton, and that's fair play. Like you do what you want afterwards, but he said everybody got ahead of themselves against Northampton, supporters and staff. Okay, and like I'll just give you an example. I'm a Man United fan, Neil, right? So we signed a player this week. I think United are going to win the title next year, right? Okay, but that's my prerogative as a supporter, right? No, but seriously, if Amorim fails next year, and he says, "Oh, the supporters thought we were going to win," like he should be fucked out. You know what I mean? Honestly, like it's irrelevant. The only people that matter about getting carried away is the players, and who's responsible for them? All right, obviously they're responsible for themselves, but that's the reality of it. So, like this stuff about getting carried away, etc. That's Leicester shouldn't be getting carried away internally because they've fallen at hurdles before. But the most important thing is this week, and I don't think it's getting carried away. It's actually are looking too far ahead. It's being in a place where everyone has absolute confidence in the game plan, and they bring the energy that's required. Because watching Glasgow the other night, I know it's an average Stormers team, but they look like they're peaking at the right time of the year, and they had a dark period during the season. But I think Franco Smith managed that, and now they're coming. They're coming, and Leicester are going to have to be good to win.
Yeah, they go, Johnny.
The attack and defence point that Burner's making. I think there's a couple of very good examples of Leinster tipping on to the outside man of the padded three, nearly in contact, and it's just like so un-Leinster. Like I don't know what they're doing. They knocked down a number of balls. They have a load of handling errors that they don't normally have, which I was shocked by. And then defensively, when you look at the Tom Rogers try, the first one, isn't it? You could see the camera went behind the Leinster defence, which was very useful. But again, to Burner's point, was it Clarkson was coming around the corner as Jamie Osborne got off the line, but Jamie Osborne didn't make it to the contact, which is fine because Jimmy O'Brien and Keenan both hit in, but they didn't really hit in. They didn't seem as connected or sure of what they were trying to hit compared to what we would have seen before. They would have stopped that 9 times out of 10, more than that, 10 times out of 10 before, you know. So I think that's the surprise for me, is that they weren't really stopping those things anymore. But the attack, just not having a clear identity. It's almost like they're trying to play more now because, Jesus, we better do something. But again, when I say going back to Stuart Lancaster about their clarity, they were just going at teams with certainty, and it's very hard to stop when you've got the firepower and resources that they have. You just can't stop that, when they keep the ball themselves, which, they're tending to just give up the ball a bit too easily at the moment with their maybe line out a couple of overthrows and then a lot of handling errors. But one last point, and I'll link it back to United maybe in a second, but I think Sam Prendergast is actually playing too much rugby. I don't understand why he played the whole game last week. Did he play the whole game? But he, for all he didn't come out at 10. And that's something that I'm like, why does he have to play every minute of every game? He doesn't really have to. And the Paul Scholes is on his podcast or whatever it was, that show that they were doing, and he was same with Hoyland playing as the striker up front at 22 years of age, and he doesn't get a chance to. I'm not my friends are mad into soccer, and I've probably just been trying to keep an eye on it. I used to be mad into it before, not as much now, but the point was really about he hasn't had a chance to sit back and watch and develop and look at things, and I think that's very pertinent to Sam Prendergast as well. Like, he's just had to be everything and do everything for everyone for the last 6 months at this stage, and that takes its toll. There's a lot being put on his shoulders, and I'm a huge fan of like his strengths, and what he can actually do in the game is unbelievable. But the gaps between the good and the bad is way too high now for him to be leading Leinster at the moment. I think Frawley needs to come in and take the load off. I don't know why they haven't done that for him.
Johnny, I think look at it, you're 100% spot on. I think it's something we do need to elaborate on further, Neil. So, effectively, even with Ireland, where it was pretty clear during the Six Nations, they were trying to get as much time into him as possible. They were like Jack was coming on, and obviously Jack played the last game against Italy, and Leinster have ended up in a situation where in a year that they kind of have to win silverware, and everything was geared up towards winning silverware, particularly Europe, because they've obviously got RG and Rabah and Geordie as well, and Geordie only for a limited window. Like they end up in a situation where what did they give Ross Byrne in a quarter final, 6 minutes, when Sam wasn't playing well, and now the problem, like Frawley came on as a fullback near the end of the game, but I like the reality is, and look back to just examples in my head, is Manny Libbok was taken off after 20 minutes. It wasn't the end of him. You know what I mean? We for some reason, it seems in Ireland, we think if a player doesn't play 60, 70 minutes, that's the end of him. It's not. It's
Yeah.
literally just it's how you manage them after that. It's how you manage them on the Monday review and how you build up their confidence again. And the problem now, I think, is that Frawley, they haven't been able to get Frawley into the form or haven't given enough game time at 10, and now they're not sure what would happen. It seems like that's the situation, because it doesn't make sense for a young fella to be playing as much game time, you would say, in his first year. But it's like they haven't any other plan or idea at the moment, and maybe they will this weekend. But certainly, you would say over the last couple of weeks, go back as far as Northampton, not having faith in Ross or Frawley to be able to come on and finish the job probably cost Leinster in the end.
Yet they made other substitutions of 46 minutes, which I was like, that's just doing it because you can. Like, there's no one wants to come off of 46 minutes. Like, Ronan Keller, I think it was RG Simon came on. I know what they're bringing off the bench is ferocious, but start him if you want to. No one wants to play 46 minutes. It's mad.
Final point on Leinster, and just looking ahead at Glasgow. And you mentioned, Bernard, obviously, how Glasgow went through a pretty sticky patch in that final four or five matches of the regular season, and obviously the last game of which was that defeat to Leinster. But that defeat to Leinster was probably one of their better outings in that kind of tail end of the regular season. They obviously got stuffed in the Champions Cup at the Aviva Stadium, but the fact that only a couple of weeks ago they were at the Aviva, put in a really, really good performance, and obviously didn't get the result. But now they fully clicked against the Stormers on Friday night. It was probably as good as they played in any game at any stage this season. Scored some brilliant tries. Franco Smith surely is going to be looking at how clunky that Leinster defence was on Saturday against the Scarlets, and he's going to fancy having a right old crack at them.
I think the problem for Leinster defensively is that Glasgow have been the best team to attack a blitz defence, and we saw that against the Stormers. Franco Smith, obviously through his time at the Cheetahs, his experience in the Northern Hemisphere, has a real understanding of what that South African defence looks like. And a friend of mine is a Stormers defence coach, Norman Aker, and he's told me consistently over the last 2 years that the team he fears the most is Glasgow, because of the level of depth they have and the pace they have on the edge and the playmakers they have in the midfield. And that was even without Hugh Jones the other night, who's nursing an Achilles tendon injury. But McDowell is also a fair decent replacement. But Tupilotu's on fire. Tom Jordan at 10. The challenge for Leinster is at the moment, there's so many dog legs in the defence that if you have a 10 who has speed and pace, they can actually crack you through the middle. So this is a big defensive challenge for Leinster. And Glasgow, just there was an energy and an edge to them, and a sense of, just we're gonna get this done. And they had to defend for big periods as well, but they did it very impressively. So yeah, I think at the weekend the two teams who got momentum out of their quarterfinals were the Bulls and the Stormers.
Speaking of the Bulls, that's who the Sharks are going to be playing on Saturday. So we'll move on to Sharks and Munster. Johnny, Sharks 24, Munster 24, 100 minutes of rugby that couldn't be separated. Sharks win on the shootout. It's the end of the road this season for Munster. The end of the road in Munster shirts for Peter O'Mahony, Conor Murray, Stephen Archer, maybe even Rory Scannell as well. Before we talk about cramp and winking and gamesmanship, just what a game of playoff rugby. Backs to the wall from both teams, some great tries, comebacks from both teams in that final quarter, a lot of errors in the humidity as well, which, errors will add to a game as well if it balances out, players going out on their shields and a bit of controversy thrown in as well. It was just brilliant playoff rugby.
It's very good as a spectacle, but I think there's aspects of it. I thought, like with Munster's line out, they clearly, I wouldn't say they shortened the menu because I haven't a clue, but what it did look like is that they went to the front to gain possession, which, I was thinking about it during the game when I was watching it, that they didn't gain any momentum from set piece. But once they kept the ball, in fairness, and I've said it before, their phase play is really good, you know. So they obviously sacrificed the ability to launch something to get the ball in their hands, and they broke out a couple of times. It was very clear that they were trying to play behind the second pod, straight from the edge. So they would sweep the first pod and then throw a deeper pass to the back and behind the second pod, which was quite clear when they actually made any moves, when they scored tries, when they made line breaks. It was most likely that which it came from. So you'd say that Munster's attack, where it functioned, was really strong, actually. You know, and I've said that. I think there was a stat that they were fourth in attack at one stage, and it's kind of in the back of my mind now. I don't know how accurate that is at the moment, but you can see that clearly. If they got a launch play, they'd be so dangerous. But they were limited in a sense then as well, because of maybe their set piece or whatever else, where they were winning the ball. The Sharks were just so disappointing in attack. So disappointing. They gave away so much ball for a team that can be really exciting and cut teams apart. They just gave away so much ball. They were heartbreaking to watch. And then obviously, like, you can see when they get momentum, Munster unfortunately gave away that penalty straight after the Kilgallen try.
Yeah.
That's what stopped them from winning the game, I would say, at that stage, because they just said they stopped a couple of mauls. Their maul defense was really good. But then it was just something like the dam was always going to break, kind of thing. And even the try to go ahead was a two-phase play. Esterhazen up the middle, and their hooker was just around the corner. Actually, Luke Hanyu-Am came on a short line and they went behind it to the forward. I was actually disappointed with Nankivell's effort on the defence there, but I don't know what was happening in it. And then Conor Murray stepping up to kick a goal, like, his class shining through. Like, that's unbelievable, and I couldn't speak more highly of Conor Murray. You might move on to him in a while when you're giving him a send-off, but, like, you know, that just typifies someone like him, you know, cool and calm and adding to the team. I thought the extra time was the biggest waste of time. I can't get that. Absolutely useless.
Both teams were just like, it obviously wasn't there, but you could sense on TV it was incredibly humid evening. Tadhg Byrne had his scrum cap off for the final 20 odd minutes. Like, I mean, that just kind of, that sums it all up. They were absolutely flaked, the lot of them.
And there was huge moments in it. Tadhg Byrne would intercept on his line. He had a couple of poaches.
Oh yeah.
Tom Ahern blocking the ball with his face. Like, there was huge moments within the game, and even there was a couple of things happened within extra time, but I watched the 20 minutes of it going, what even happened? They were throwing the ball to each other. And then the penalty shootout, like, I'm not sure how I feel about it, but obviously it adds a serious tension and the antics, and sure, we're talking about it since, you know. So really good game of knockout rugby, but Munster would be disappointed that they had an opportunity to get over the line. I know from speaking to people in there that they were quite confident in what they could do, and they very nearly did it, and I think it's an opportunity lost.
Yeah, on the opportunity lost part, Bernard, before we kind of get onto the shootout and the drama of the whole thing, like, 21-10 up with 20 minutes to go, they're going to have regrets about it, specifically about just the way they handled that restart after going 21-10 ahead. Sharks get a penalty straight from the restart, and, you know, it gives them the platform to just keep coming back into it. And also as well, it's kind of a miracle they got to that stage of the game, or even got as far as place kicks with the scrum the way it went. I don't know how many penalties exactly were given away at the scrum. The stats available from the match are pretty poor. But, you know, it was in the four or five region, I would be saying. Didn't help, obviously, that Josh Witcherly and Diarmaid Barron had to go off injured so soon after coming on. So it means Michael Milne and Niall Scannell have to play about 85 to 90 minutes of rugby each. But, like, if you're Clayton McMillan coming in next season, I think it's fairly obvious the area that needs to be addressed faster than anything else.
Yeah, of course. And they've already done a little bit around that, with,
yeah,
obviously, with Milne and Barron. But obviously with Archer finishing up, there's certainly, and we don't know, like, Roman Salanoa apparently is going to be fit for pre-season. But realistically, given his injury profile over the last 5 years, 6 years, you know, even when he was in Leinster,
you can't bank on him playing 20 plus games next season.
No, you can't. And I think the problem for them is they need a scrummaging tight head who also gives them a lot of bang as well. You know, they probably need another ball carrier, an explosive ball carrier. And look, McMillan will have great links to quality in the Southern Hemisphere. And I understand that the RFU will allow them bring in a non-Irish qualified prop. So the RFU have done a U-turn on that decision earlier in the year, which I think is justified. But that recruitment piece will be really important. Odogbo obviously is coming back. He'll give him a bit more punch as well in the front five. But The challenge for Munster is just Tyburn has just been immense all season when they needed him. And again, you're just looking at his load and going on the Lions tour. You know, it's definitely going to have, others are going to have to carry some of that
Yes.
load next year. But I think McMillan coming in will give them all a big lift. And he's getting a team who are honest, you know, a real honest team who fight for everything. And they know, like, that scrum was so bad on the Sharks' ball that the game should have been, you know, over because of that. But
It's
Munster
a, it's as
winning.
much a, it's as much a reflection on the Sharks,
Yeah.
like as a team as it is on Munster's scrum. Like
Yeah, I think so.
when
I
your
think
scrum is
so.
that dominant, I don't see how you get as far as 24 all and needing the place kicks.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, they were just so wasteful. And look at Munster made him work, but you felt, if you're Dennis Leamy, you're saying make him go four phases plus and they'll actually make a mistake. And that's kind of how it played out. So that's the area. Great to see your lineout back kind of looking in sync. And they're very good on transition and they're very good on counter-attack. And Kilcallan's been a really good recruit for them as well to add to what they already had. So yeah, I'd be much happier about Munster now, going into next year, but I do think they do need to sign a couple for sure.
Let's talk about the fun stuff. Jaden Hendricks has joined an elite club of Munster enemies. Neil Back is in there. I'd say Rory Cockott is in there. There's probably a handful of others. Maybe the YouTube commenters can give us their favorite Munster enemies. But Jaden Hendricks, Johnny, is right in there. Now, he obviously had cramp. We've all seen the screenshots of the calf, which was completely seizing up. It probably didn't help his cause that he had to be warned by Mike Adamson for mouthing off at Jack Crowley a couple of minutes before that as well. And I would suggest that while he did have cramp, he made sure he milked it while he was on the ground. And obviously the wink then as well thrown in on top. Fair play to the TV director
What a shot.
who zoomed in on him. It was like he knew he was going to wink. It was absolutely outstanding. We've seen a lot of hot takes on it over the last few days. Some people think it's the greatest, some people think it's the greatest act of messing they've ever seen. Some people think it's brilliant. Some people think he should be banned for life, or I don't know where you're sitting on it. For me personally, I think, I mean, not exactly a punishable defense or offense, but just probably lacked a bit of class, I think, all
Yeah,
around.
I didn't like it, and at the time I was like, "What's he doing?" But when you settle down and think about it, you know, I don't think it's the same as being in a scuffle and mouthing off and saying something. I think it's completely different, you know. So, and sledging happens in the game all game long. So, like, when you settle down and think about it, Irish players have obviously given out their fair share, but it's when you do it, I think, is the part of the sportsmanship that I probably just didn't like. The Lucanio Am when Conor Murray was standing over that penalty, Lucanio Am was stretching his calves on the point where he was putting the tee down as well. I don't think it's a mistake that they started getting cramp, which probably pissed me off a small bit, you know, when I saw that part back. It didn't help that he was mouthing off to Jack in the first kick. But again, you know, he's mouthing off going past him. It's his right to try and get in his head if he wants to do that. If that's how he wants to carry himself, then off you go. And for whatever reason, I'd love to know why. There was obviously a lot going on that we couldn't pick up on because Munster were. There was quite an emotional response, obviously, from Jack as well. He didn't like it in the first kick, and he certainly lost his cool in the fourth kick, his second attempt. I loved that he was like to Mike Adamson, "No, I'm kicking it," and he was like so petulant at that stage. I was loving that, but I don't think Mike Adamson did much to simmer down that even the chat throughout the game. I think he was trying to answer for himself. I didn't really like that he couldn't control the game. But anyway, long story short, I think we can't be too sensitive around a wink. At that stage, he was on the ground. He clearly had cramp. He was getting away with what he was trying to do. And a harmless wink, who really cares? Like,
Bernard, your thoughts? I mean, the wink could easily even just be to Jack Crowley. I'll be up in a minute. Don't worry about it.
yeah,
You know, like
that.
now I think what added to it is there was obviously verbals going on from all over the place. Like after Rory Scannell made his second kick, he turns around to the Shark bench and gives it the kind of yapping sign. So there was obviously a lot going on.
Yeah, there was, and actually, I've been sent the ref mic from earlier on for the first kick. Someone says to Jack, he's a 40% kicker before he kicks it, So that obviously was why Jack was so fired up. But I actually like look at I didn't it didn't have an effect on the actual result because Jack nailed his two,
Yeah.
Connor nailed his two, and unfortunately
I'm de
Rory's.
sorry, I'm delighted it didn't actually have a material
Yeah,
effect
me
on
too.
the kicks.
Me too. Yeah. So look at it, it's just to be honest, Neil, officials are struggling to control things they see every week. So when you see a penalty shootout once every whatever 3 or 4 years, you know it's bound to be not marshaled properly. And I even think where Scanlon was kicking from, like he was right beside the Sharks bench. So unless the
Yeah.
Sharks bench are really disciplined, there is going to be verbals there. And I think that's where he was directing his frustration with. Yeah, so it wasn't nice, but I wasn't overly. I didn't go to bed that night thinking they were robbed either.
No. It just makes me look forward to the Sharks and Munster meeting again. And specifically, probably the next time Jaden Hendricks is playing for the Sharks against Munster as well. One last p point on the kicks, though, Johnny, from a kicker's point of view. A lot of people have questioned why Jack Crowley was taking those ones from the central spot, from the centre of the 20 or edge of the 22 and then out of the 40-metre line as well. The average person might think, would you not have your best kicker taking the more difficult kick, maybe out on the right or out on the left? There's obviously the other theory as well. He came into the game with a pretty bad rib injury that he was playing through. You could see him just before the place kicking competition actually taking off a load of strapping around his ribs. Conor Murray had taken that one late on in the game, which I know Conor Murray takes a lot of long range kicks, but that one. The distance wise, it was probably about 46, 47 meters. You probably would have said it was in Crowley's range normally. So there's probably the school of thought that maybe he was carrying a knock and didn't feel that comfortable moving out towards the touch lines. I don't know what your thoughts would be on it. Do some kickers just have preferences for areas of the pitch?
I know that some kickers would have a bogey spot, definitely,
Yeah.
but so there's a couple of things to it. I don't think the rib decided where he kicked from in the penalty shootout. The rib might have decided that Conor Murray would kick the last longer range kick because I wouldn't say he has it in his range, but it's certainly getting to the outer part of the range, especially when it's at a small angle on the right-hand side of the post. But Conor obviously thumped his one and sent it home fairly easily. So I don't think that was beyond his range, but if you are at the edge of your maximum force or whatever, then that's where your rib is going to get sore. So I can understand that one and maybe Connor taking that over. Jack also missed from the right-hand side of the post in the first half to go 10 up. So maybe it was just playing on his mind that side of the post wasn't doing it for him. That's one answer. A left footer at that side of the post obviously makes complete sense. I think Rory just got slightly close. I'm not sure if I'm right, but it looked like he got slightly close and then turned into the ball a bit too much. I don't know. I think you can question it all you want, but there was an easy logic as to why they kicked the kicks in the order that they kicked them. So I don't know. People kind of I think there's a bit of an overreaction to Hendricks. Wait till you get to Thomond Park next year, and I think there's an overreaction to who kicked the goals at what
Don't
spot.
be saying that, Johnny. Don't
It's
be.
a massive
Don't
overreaction.
turn down the heat on that pot.
Yeah.
Let it
Well, I
simmer
think
over the summer. Let it simmer
oh.
over the summer.
A lot of bravery going on social media, I think. But no, I think you can kind of dissect it every way you want. But if they kick their kicks, no one asks any questions,
You mentioned him earlier on, Conor Murray, and the balls he had to step up and take that. And you mentioned how much of a professional he's been down the years and your experiences of him as well. You wrote a nice piece yesterday for RTÉ about the changing of the guard at Munster and, Conor Murray moving on, Peter Omahuny, Stephen Archer, Rory Scannell, we think is going as well. That's 900 plus appearances straight out of the Munster squad already. They've all played their part massively down this stretch. And I think, if Scannell is leaving, it's a tough way for him to go. Obviously, bittersweet. He got his 200th appearance, which is a something really, really nice for him as well. But can you just talk to us about, I suppose, those four lads, Stephen Archer as well? I mean, had played 65 plus minutes at the weekend. I was looking through. I couldn't get the final player stats at the end of the game, but he was one of Munster's highest tacklers by the point he went off. I know he had a tough game at the scrum, but for someone of his age running around in that humidity, contributing everywhere he could. Like, they left it all out there in the end.
Yeah, they did. And it looks like Niall Scanlon put up an Instagram post about his last game with his brother. So I assume it is his last game with his brother. But, so, Eric, look, I think those four guys in particular is woven into the fabric of Munster. And I think you can't think about a Munster game in the last 10 years or so where they don't have a big impact on the game. You know what I mean? So, I think people like Archer and Rory, it's going to be like a backhanded compliment, but the other two are, seasoned internationals and Lions, and there's going to be an outpouring over them, and rightly so. The mindset, the professionalism, and I've spoken to all that, but Rory is such a good fella. He's 200 appearances for your province in your home province, where there's a lot of family connection. His uncle Tadhg is a doctor, and Niall obviously there as well. It just means so much to their family, and obviously Billy's with us in Cár Chán, and came through the Munster system as well. So Munster's in their DNA, and I think Rory gave so much to the club. He should be thanked for that, because there were periods where Munster weren't going very well that Rory was the shining light, and I've played through some of that, and he was beside me as a younger player, kind of guiding me. You know what I mean? So very intelligent fella, massive capacity for the game, and just lives and breathes it. So unbelievable career. I don't know what he's doing next, but I think it's important that he gets the recognition of what he's done for the club. Archer the same. 300 appearances. I was looking at Dan Cole, and for whatever reason, maybe it's there a few look after us a bit better over here, but English players can rack up numbers. No one in Ireland racks up numbers like that. It's unbelievable what he's done in a position like that. And I've spoken about, Archer, when I came into the kind of senior setup, and obviously there's a lot of professionals there, but I was just maybe taken aback by a prop running these paces, maybe plodding. I wouldn't call him a speed merchant, but the robustness, the ability to come back from a neck injury or two, and then also running seriously good times on a 1K with his watch on and taking control of everything. It was just one of these moments where you remembered as a younger player, and he was one of them, and I suppose to make a potentially very long answer very, very quick, Conor, I've spoken about him all the time. The biggest thing that I'd see with Murray is that, I've tried to express it in a column, but he'd come back from a Lions tour and be 8 out of 10 Conor Murray, be leader of, I suppose, not the leadership in a Peter Romani way, but leadership of standards and performance, where he's never going to drop below. It sounds like insulting, but below 7 out of 10. If you can give 7 or 8 out of 10 every week, that's an unbelievable return. And he just did that time and time again while being at the top of the global game at times. So, what he has done in both jerseys and in the Lions, he's been a global star. And that's what I remember of him being around the environment, that you've got a guy who's so high up in people's recognition of being at the top of the game, and then he's just a very normal fella. And the last one in Pete, it's just his mind, isn't it? It's just apps It has to be his mind. Physically, people don't understand that his jump height is ridiculous, and that's why his line has been really good. But it's his intelligence around the line, his intelligence of and rugby IQ around the pitch. His skills are way better than what people give him credit for as well. But it's his intelligence and rugby IQ around those skills, and when to do things selflessly, giving that pass there 2 weeks ago or whatever it was for the try. So anyway, I think to give Bernard a chance at actually speaking, I think the value we hold on those four players is absolutely huge. And Munster have an unbelievable job on their hands to replace some of those personalities within the group. Notwithstanding, as Bernard said, Tadhg's going to miss a lot of next season, really, if you think about it, or at least a late start. So they're going to be missing a lot going into next season, which is an opportunity for others. But unbelievable servants to Munster, and it can't go unnoticed,
To follow on from the last point Johnny made there, Bernard, and we'll finish the podcast on that then, the opportunity for others and responsibility for others now to really step up. It's going to be really interesting to see how that leadership vacuum gets filled over the course of next season. But I think going off what we would have seen over that, probably this season, I would say, you're looking at, specifically, I think you're looking at Craig Casey and Jack Crowley as two people pretty much ready now to step into that role as the on-field leaders, the standard setters. I think Crowley, the way he's handled what's been a difficult season at times, on and off, on and off the pitch with speculation around his future, I think he's come into this final third of the season in some of the best form we've seen from him in the last couple of seasons. Casey got that injury early on in the season, but has got right back up to speed again. They look like the kind of two players that leadership-wise, this team is going to be built around. I know Tadhg Byrne obviously is still there as well, but as we've said, with Lions Tour and internationals might not be available as much next season.
Yeah, they're going to be massive, and obviously they're two guys who are going to be on the field for the big games, you'd imagine. But I think it's what that leadership group is like, and the ones who aren't maybe guaranteed starters and the influence they have. And I think someone, you know, like Rory, I think Rory Scannell, from everything I heard about him, he was someone that was highly respected, a real driver of standards, and wasn't always first choice, you know, but yet has had an unbelievable career in Red. And I think I've been really impressed by that player group without knowing exactly who's in it, but this year as it finished, because I think they over the last month have certainly got together and got very tight and made sure the Munster qualified for Europe, which was no gimme, just the situation they got themselves in, and went out and gave it everything they had in a quarter final. So that even experience of that for the likes of Casey and Kendallin and Crowley and Nankovic, etc., who you would think are going to be key people for them, is really important, because they're not going to have the level of support that Leinster have in terms of central contracts, or they just need to find their best way of maximising what they have. And I think the trials and tribulations they've had this season, and how they just finished it, will stand to them when they come back in over the summer.
All right, very good, fellas. We'll skip talking about this OR360 franchise league, which has kind of been floated in the last couple of days. We might save that for another day if it picks up any legs. That's where we'll leave it for this podcast. Johnny and Bernard, thanks a million. A reminder, live coverage of Leinster and Glasgow in the URC semi-finals. Coverage gets underway from 2:15 p.m. on RT2 and RT Player, and live commentary as well on RT Radio 1's Saturday Sport. We'll speak to you again soon.